crowd. Look who it is.
It's the Mole Man.
Hey there, and welcome to Marvel by the Month. My name's Brian Stratton.
And I am Rob Milne.
And this episode's a little different. Something has come up. We don't know what exactly it is, but we got thrown off of our regular recording schedule. But fortunately, past Rob and Brian were smart enough to help out future Rob and Brian by recording a few of these what we're going to call fill-in issues. So those of you who are comics fans will know that every now and then the unforgiving publishing deadlines of the comic book industry run smack up against the real world. And that means that you need to quickly figure out what you're going to publish instead of the issue that you planned on publishing and didn't have ready in time. So that's what this is. It's a fill-in issue because, yeah, like I said, something went wrong. We don't know what it is.
Or something went right.
Or something went terribly right for us.
Maybe we had a crazy night before we recorded this.
Yep.
We meant to record the next episode. So yeah, here you are. And notoriously, these were blamed, the fill-in issues were blamed on, you know, artists.
Right.
You know, most always. They're the, you know, the script's done.
Yep.
Why isn't the art done?
Right. Well, and yeah, since you are, you know, the guy who does all the music for the podcast and has designed our logo and everything else, I'm going to say that whatever happened, it was your fault.
That makes sense.
Okay, great.
It's highly likely.
Excellent.
When I spoke up for the artist, I was also, you know, saying, yeah, we're flaky.
A little premature CYA. Well, great. So, you know, welcome to the first fill-in issue. I'm guessing this will not be the last one that we have to do. But this one, we thought what we would do is take a deep dive into Stan Lee's original Fantastic Four synopsis.
Yeah.
So if you want to follow along with this and read the original pitch that he put together for what the Fantastic Four was going to be, probably the easiest way to find it would be through the Marvel Comics Unlimited app. And just look up the Fantastic Four facsimile edition from 2018. And this is included in the bonus matter. In there, it's a two-page typewritten synopsis typed up by Stan. As we're about to talk about, there's some controversy around exactly how much of this is Stan and how much of this is Jack Kirby.
Yeah, and we've talked about this when we did episode one. So this is going to be a great, you know, bonus episode to episode one.
Yes.
For those anybody who gets back there it's and wants to put up with our, you know, a not so fancy setup, our audio setup.
Oh,
so
boy,
you can hear all the cracks. Yeah,
and the two guys trying to figure out how to do a podcast and having no idea technically or host wise how that should work.
Also, just we talk like, you know, a normal conversation a lot of the time. So there's a lot of ums and pauses. See, there's one. And once you've done about 17 episodes, you become fairly allergic to them. So you cut out, let's say, 50%. And that's about as fancy as I think we're going to get with our radio voices. But it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Welcome back to Fantastic Four number one. And so like we mentioned in our very first episode, there's a lot of controversy around who created the Fantastic Four exactly. So Jack Kirby and his estate spent years taking legal action against Marvel Comics to earn him the creator/ownership credit that he and his estate felt that he deserved. There were times in the past when Stan was very generous about giving Kirby credit. There were also times when he was much less generous about giving Jack credit. And a lot of this had to do with, you know, what Jack's relationship was with Marvel at the time. In the 70s, he left Marvel to go to DC Comics and had some very, very hard feelings toward his former publisher. And so he, you know, not only came up with not a different version of events, but he was much more proactive about asserting his role in the creation of Marvel characters than he had been when he was inside the company. He also created a at least one character who was a very unflattering caricature of Stan Lee called Funky Flashman.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah. toward the end of his life, Jack did have some very hard feelings towards Stan and Marvel. But to a degree, Stan and Jack did reconcile before he passed. So that's good because, you know, they were both very important to everything that came out of their partnership.
And they had an insane history. I mean, Stan, I was reading some biography things, and Stan noted that he started at Marvel when he was 17.
Yeah.
And when he's and timely at the time, Jack was one of the people running it.
Yes, that's right.
And Jack left to do other things. And in the time between, Stan stayed there for 22 years. And that's when we hit 1961. Mm-hmm. And that's when we hit. So Stan was 39 when he wrote the script for Fantastic Four number one.
Or did he?
Somewhat.
Yeah. I mean, Stan definitely, he was a company man. He came in, like you said, early to Timely Comics, stayed with it all the way through Marvel, stayed very friendly with Marvel even after he was no longer the editor. His cousin was the publisher, Martin Goodman, for years. So, there was a lot of incentive for Stan to, you know, assert himself as the sole creator or the primary creator. And the company had a vested interest in backing Stan up on that. So
one distinction I learned from this bio today, Martin Goodman was cousin in law. Mm. So the husband of a cousin.
Okay.
That I did not know, and I just uncovered. So it was like, it's worth mentioning. Sometimes I read things.
Some things that are not just comic books.
That may not even be correct on Wikipedia for all I know. This is from Stan's mouth. So, okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah, who knows? But speaking of things that we have read, here's something that I read. Mark Evanier, he's a comics writer and a historian and a former assistant of Kirby's. In 2011, he was testifying in a case between Marvel and Jack's estate. This was his sworn testimony, his account of what he believed the creation of Fantastic Four involved. So these are all quotes from Evanier. The storyline of Fantastic Four is very similar in a number of ways to a comic Jack had done previously called The Challengers of the Unknown. Very similar structure to the characters. It feels an awful lot more like Jack's earlier work than anything that Stan had done to that date. So I find it very difficult to believe that Jack did not have input into the creation of the characters prior to that synopsis, whenever it was composed. And also, I have the fact that I talked to Stan many times and he told me, and he said it in print in a few places, that he and Jack had sat down one day and figured out what the Fantastic Four would be. So, I mean, there's no dispute that what we're about to go through, that Stan was the one who actually typed up the synopsis. That's, you know, there's no question around that. There is considerable dispute about how much input Jack had in it. And Evanier, 3 years prior to that testimony, he wrote and published a book called Kirby, King of Comics. And the way that he summed up the opinion of Stan and Jack's comics contemporaries was that Fantastic Four was created by Stan and Jack. No further division of credit seemed appropriate.
Yeah.
So there you go. It's a Stan and Jack creation. It is neither one nor the other. And we're not going to get involved in trying to pick nits and determine, you know, percentages of ownership and things like that. You know, as I mentioned, in our relationship, you know, I'm the writer and you're the artist. So I'm really just setting you up so that I can take sole ownership of this going forward. So,
or you're setting me up so I can dispute it.
Oh, man.
And, yeah,
I didn't think this through. All right. Well, regardless, let's leave that to our future estates lawyers to settle.
And may they have a long and healthy battle.
And, you know, at one point, you know, right toward the end, there's going to be an M. Night Shyamalan-esque twist. And like Disney is just going to roll in and crush everyone because this is not our intellectual property, people.
Yep.
Okay. So shall we take a look at the original synopsis?
Yeah.
And how about we do something like this? How about why don't you go through what Stan typed down, and I will kind of follow along with Fantastic Four number one, and we'll see how much of what he put down actually came to be.
That sounds perfect. And keep in mind, this will become very apparent as we go through it, but Stan did not write a script as you think of a script.
Right.
Stan did when we say light sketch, I think it's much more than that, but he did not paint panel by panel, insist on what was going to happen, set the scene like a screenplay or any other script. It's higher level than that.
Yeah, I think it's worth maybe just taking a minute to talk about the Marvel method of comic book writing, which is DC and a lot of other comics publishers go through a much more traditional, you know, like screenplay style format, where the writer describes what's happening on each page, even to like a panel breakdown, and writes all the dialogue, and then hands that over to an artist who just basically executes against that. With the Marvel method, and this was something that was pioneered by Stan and Jack, the writer would take first crack and do a basic high-level summary of what was taking place in the story. The artist would take that. It was the artist's responsibility to break it down page by page, panel by panel, tell the story in a visual way, and then it would be handed back to the writer, who would then add the dialogue.
Yeah. So that's very different than what you would expect, and that's a lot of leeway.
Yes.
So in a traditional, you know, movie making, you have a shot by shot. This would be more like somebody describing what's going to happen in the movie and say, you photographers, you actors, everyone else, just sort of work it out.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that it's a huge amount of artistic license, which again lends towards the story that Jack obviously has to do a lot of thinking, a lot of, you know, the devil's in the details. And that's where Jack was.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the advantages of it is it gives the artist a much more collaborative role in what's going on. The downside, you know, as we have seen with Marvel's legal history, is that it's really, really challenging to prove who did what and when and how. So because, you know, a lot of these things were based on informal conversations around the office. Like, there's no paper trail for most of it.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's take a look at what Stan actually wrote down, and then what wound up on the page.
Okay, let's dive in. So here we are, synopses, The Fantastic Four, July 61 schedule, number one. All of this, by the way, is typed out, and it looks like it's been through four fax machines. So I'm going to do my best to not maim anything.
All right.
This story number one, introduction, Meet the Fantastic Four. This story is told in two chapters. Chapter one is 6 pages long. Chapter two is 5 pages.
So basically, this winds up being the first couple chapters of Fantastic Four number one. So everything up to the point where they wind up going after the Mole Man. So this is the origin of the Fantastic Four.
And this is what we believe. I don't know the provenance of the whole thing, but to be the remaining pieces of the script. I've never seen, and I couldn't find the rest of the script.
Yeah, so me neither.
We're going to talk through chapters one and two, and then we'll summarize the rest of the action. And talk about, you know, what that means going from this perspective. So now we get to the character introductions. There are four main characters. One, Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic. He is young, handsome scientist, leader of the four, invents a spaceship to go to Mars, hopes to be first man to reach Mars.
Okay, so most of that winds up on the page, except they don't go to Mars. I think they're just trying to get into orbit.
And we'll learn as we read through this why Mars was written in here.
Mm-hmm.
Two, Susan Storm, Invisible Girl. She's Reed's girlfriend. She's an actress, beautiful, glamorous.
Well, she's a lovely woman. She is Reed's girlfriend, sort of. Although there's some ambiguity once Namor shows up.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no mention of her being an actress, although later on in the Fantastic Four, in future issues, we do see her doing things like, you know, being in photo shoots, and she gets an opportunity to star in a Hollywood movie, and she's very excited about that. So
at this phase, there's no mention. Yeah.
Right. But we'll say like 80%. 80%. Yeah.
Ben Grimm, the Thing. Ben is very husky, brutish guy. He's a pilot. He falls for Susan also.
Now that is a character trait that did not stick around with Ben. So he definitely, he's a pilot. He is a husky brute. There's no implication that he is sweet on Sue anywhere in, I think, any of the Fantastic
Four. Well, I think there's a little bit of sort of jealous talk in even in issue one where he's like, you know, Sue wouldn't look at me that way. There's a couple places where he says that in the early issues.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, it's possible that that was going to be developed more, but then they brought in Alicia.
Yeah.
And Alicia Masters sort of took Ben's heart.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it does seem like from the beginning that Stan and Jack had thought like it'd be really interesting to have a rival for Sue's affections. But that wound up being Namor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and then number four of the four main characters, Johnny Storm, Human Torch. He is Susan's kid brother, a teenager, 17 years old, high school star athlete.
I don't see him being referred to as an athlete anywhere. And he's 16, not 17.
Yeah. So, in Strange Tales, they said 16. Yeah. So they contradict that.
Yep.
Okay, and this is also telling. Here's the next line.
Okay.
Story might open with a meeting of Fantastic Four.
Right.
And also my English is going to be broken because that's just sort of how this script is written.
Yeah.
So as meeting starts, caption tells reader what we will go back a few weeks to see how it all began.
Yeah, and that sort of happens. So the first page of Fantastic Four has Reed firing off the flare gun. And he says, it's the first time I found it necessary to give the signal. I pray it will be the last. And then that's the catalyst for each of the individual members of the Fantastic Four to see the flare and show off their powers as they are coming to meet up with Reed. But it doesn't start off with all four of them, you know, in the room.
Yeah, so that's it's a big departure, but also a better way to tell the story.
Yeah, yeah.
So totally. He's taking the introduction piece, Jack has presumably, yep. and again, there may be discussions between Jack and Stan, between the synopses and when Jack put pen to paper, but we don't know.
Yeah,
this is what we have.
Yep, but they do all wind up in the same room. Starting on page 9, and then they do flashback to their origins. So it does happen. It just doesn't lead off the issue.
Yeah, which is it's a better, breakup of time and totally. To tease it in.
Yep.
So then we get everyone in the room. Reed Richards tells Susan and her brother, or we don't know that they're in the room. This is what Stan assumed.
Yep.
Reed Richards tells Susan and her brother Johnny that his spaceship is finally completed. He hopes to be first man to Mars, but he needs a pilot. They hire Ben Grimm. Ben is huge, surly, unpleasant guy who doesn't want any part of project until he sees Susan. He falls for Susan, and she manages to coax him into piloting the ship. Ben is crackerjack pilot, ex-war hero, best pilot available.
Yeah. So Sue doesn't really coax Ben into piloting the ship as much as she says that I never thought that you would be a coward. And then he smashes a table and then he decides that he'll do it. But there's no hiring Ben. He's already part of the team at this point. His concern is that they haven't done enough research on the cosmic rays. And he's afraid that they're just going to kill them if they get into space and they're not shielded properly.
Which covers on the next little paragraph here. As the four are about to begin flight, they are warned against it by authorities, told that no one yet knows what effect cosmic rays will have on human bodies so far out in space, but they decide to go anyway. They fear that if they don't go, Reds may beat us to it.
Yep.
And so that's again, Jack has taken, as far as we can tell,
mm-hmm.
the license to have Ben already aware of this. They're already discussing this. It's not like at the last minute somebody says, beware the cosmic rays.
Right, right.
And then there's also this great note from Stan in this synopsis. At the rate the communists are progressing in space, maybe we better make this a flight to the stars instead of just to Mars. Because by the time this mag goes on sale, the Russians may have already made a flight to Mars.
which just goes to show Stan didn't have a great grasp of, you know, what would go into a, you know, a flight that we still have not made in 2019.
He's but Stan is nothing if not idealistic, you know?
Right. So, yeah. He really believes in the power of commies.
Yeah. At this point. So without clearance from the authorities in the dead of night, they take off for the nearest star very dramatically.
And that tracks. That's they do that. They sneak onto the base and they take off in the rocket.
And now in space on the way to the stars, poof, they are bombarded by cosmic rays, which penetrate the ship and which affect all four of the occupants. They can't continue the trip, have to turn back, are lucky to land alive. But they are all different now. They sense it, although they don't yet quite know how they've changed.
So that's all, you know, straight up, except instead of poof, the sound effect was rack, tack, 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 tack.
Yeah, so, much better. And for anybody who's been in like an MRI.
Yeah.
suddenly, they can't see Susan, but they know she's there. They can hear her. They realize she has become invisible. She cannot become visible again. Later, she will buy a mask with a face like the one she had, and she will have to wear that mask in order to be seen. Her clothes, of course, can be seen, so it is only her flesh that is invisible. When she takes her clothes off, she's completely invisible. I hope this won't be too sexy in artwork. Better talk to me about it, Jack. Maybe we'll change this gimmick somewhat.
There's so much I love about that paragraph. I mean, first of all, obviously that's not how Sue's powers wind up working. She does not have to buy a mask. She does, you know, quickly become visible again. Her clothes turn invisible and stop, you know, and become revisible again. But the whole idea of like Stan, it's really unclear who he's writing this to. It's like, is this to Martin Goodman? Is this for himself? Like, he's talking to Jack here, but he's also like putting down a bunch of stuff that it's assumed that Jack already knows. So it's it's just wild. It's really fun. But, you know, they disregarding the details of it all. Sue is the first person to of the four to demonstrate her ability. So,
yeah.
So that part tracks. But the whole like, she's got to get nude to be completely invisible is just.
And then how sexy that might be.
Right.
Which also reminds me of the episode we had with Noah Campbell on it. And Noah, there was like a pinup at the end of the book. And it had, you could see halfway through Sue and to the controls of the Fantastic Car.
Yes.
And he was saying something like, ooh, la, la.
Yeah.
It's so, this outline is so sexy. And now I'm like, well, he might have been of a mind with Stan Lee.
Exactly. It's also great just the way that you see Stan's thought process. Like, he's quickly jotting down these notes and then he's sort of realizing the implications of what he's typing. He's like, actually, like, having the only female character have to get naked to use her power, that might be problematic.
Pushing it too far.
Yeah.
I love the way this is like a half post-it, half just like something you wake up and you just stutter something into a tape to remember what it is.
I was going to say, it reminds me of Dale Cooper just dictating notes on his little recorder to Diane in Twin Peaks.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So, okay, now we get to, so we've gone through the whole invisible sexiness. And now, as for Johnny, Susan's brother, whenever he gets excited, he bursts into flame, becomes a human torch, and can fly as his body gets lighter than air, but doesn't last for more than 5 minutes. At end of 5 minutes, his flame goes out and he becomes normal again until he gets excited again, but can't flame on for at least 5 minutes after he's gotten back to normal. Comics Association told me he may never burn anyone with flame. He may only burn ropes, doors, etc., never people. And he cannot toss fireballs as the old Human Torch could. His biggest asset is that he can fly.
Well, I mean, a lot of that holds up. In the early days, he does think that he can fly because he's lighter than air. His flame does last about 5 minutes. But he does use fireballs like that.
Yeah, it yes. happens pretty fast.
Yeah, Stan may have been misinformed on that point.
Or they negotiated it, you know, down. If the fireballs are not used to burn human flesh, right. you're cool.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't ever, like, just set someone on fire, which, you know. He almost sets people on fire, right. but he doesn't quite do it.
It makes more sense when you consider the comics code at this point, you know, yeah. like, because that power is just dangerous all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. We should do another one of these on the comics code.
You know what? I think you're right.
Yeah.
Just cover that. So sort of that's part of the creation of all this. So,
yes. Yeah. Oh, and also Johnny's the last one to display his talents. In the original story. So it goes in the original story, it goes, Sue, Ben, Reed, Johnny. So the order is a little swapped.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's get into Reed.
Yeah.
So they think Reed Richards, the pilot, he forgot that Ben was, is right. unaffected by cosmic rays as he seems normal until he tries to reach for something. Then they realize his arm has stretched toward the thing he reached for. Just like that yeah. description, that vagary.
He does reach toward the thing in the first episode, but yeah, not in the way that Stan was thinking.
After a while, they realize Reed's body has become like rubber. He can get skinny, elongated, anything that you can do with rubber. He can squeeze through keyholes, etc. Of course, the more stretched out he gets, the weaker he gets. But the point remains that he can twist and stretch his body into almost any shape.
Yep. I mean, that's pretty tracks pretty closely to how it winds up.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to parse it. There's just like the type letter E and O next to each other. So, but it's really, I think he can even alter the appearance of his face to make himself look like someone else.
Now, that's something he didn't ever do. And that is much more of like a Plastic Man type thing.
Or Clayface.
Or Clayface.
The
yep.
DC universe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
But it is quite painful to do all this. So he can only maintain the strange shapes for a very short period of time until the pain gets to be unbearable.
Yeah. And that was never a part of Reed's character, really.
Yeah. I think they mentioned that in one of the sort of, so not, or the ask me anything.
Right, right.
Trying to summarize that the letters page
when Reed goes on Reddit in 1962.
First, Reed makes Reddit or makes the internet.
Right.
Okay. So finally, Ben Grimm steps out of the shadows. They all gasp. His body has changed in the most grotesque way of all. He's sort of shapeless. He's become a thing, and he's grown more fantastically powerful than any other living thing. He is stronger than an elephant, but he is so heavy that he moves very slowly. He's very ponderous, and these slow, ponderous movements should make him look very dramatic. He cannot alter his appearance as the others can, so he must wear a coat with turned-up collar, sunglasses, slouch hat, and gloves when he goes out in public. But when he takes them off, he is a thing.
Yep. Yeah, and that's Ben's, you know, going out clothes, his pervert coat and hat.
Yeah. He does have an ascot or a scarf usually.
Yes.
And that's how they start the issue with yeah. him in that getup. So that's accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. That tracks.
Okay. Now Stan says, so much for who they are and how they got that way. Now here's a gimmick I think we might play up to advantage. Let's make the thing the heavy. In other words, he's not really a good guy. He's part of the Fantastic Four because they all got that way together and they decide to remain a team, and also because he has a crush on Susan. But actually, he is jealous of Mr. Fantastic and dislikes Human Torch because Torch always sides with Fantastic.
And that's, I mean, Ben, early on, and we've talked about this a lot, he is pretty close to being a villain or at least an anti-hero. And it's really not until he meets Alicia that he winds up being a much more, you know, sympathetic character and a heroic character. He does have a rivalry with a Torch, but again, you know, like there's no obvious crush that he has on Sue. He's not a rival for her affections. So I think his villainous stature is kind of overrated here, but you know, in the early days, he certainly is. He's less heroic than any of the other three.
Yeah. And so here's to complete the idea from Stan. Let's treat him so that Reader is always afraid he will sabotage the Fantastic Four's efforts at whatever they are doing. He isn't interested in helping mankind the way the other three are. He is more interested in winning Susan away from Mr. Fantastic. We might indicate that he feels he may return to his normal self at any time, because none of them know how long their strange powers will last, or whether the effect of the cosmic rays will one day wear off.
Again, like the villainous nature is kind of overstated here, because Ben says, like, right after they get their powers, you don't have to make a speech, Big Shot. We understand. We've got to use this power to help mankind, right? So, I mean, he is, you know, he's grumpy. He's traumatized, but he's not, I mean, the Hulk winds up being this character. Like, this all gets, you know, put on the Hulk.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea moves on to a more unlikable monster.
Yeah.
And I think so we can tell between writing this, maybe even between Jack drawing it and Stan going back to put in the words, he's decided, you know, Ben's got to be, he can be kind of this, but he's still, he's not a complete villain.
Yeah. And considering how, you know, the Hulk only lasted 6 issues. So like you have to wonder if they had actually executed on this original idea of Ben being the Hulk, you know, being this villainous creature, like, would the Fantastic Four have actually worked, you know?
Right.
And I'm really glad that they didn't go down that path, because I'm not sure it would have.
Yeah. It's like having a villain built into the team.
Yeah.
And it doesn't last long when you're actually trying to get something done against villains. I mean, in the logic of comics.
Well, and it also would have totally broken the idea of the Fantastic Four being a family.
Yeah.
Which is the strength of the team, I think.
Agreed. Last big paragraph here. Anyway, the four of them decide to form a unit. They think it is an act of fate which made them as they are, and they think they owe it to fate to use their powers to help mankind. It's just what we were talking about.
Yep.
So they adopt their new names, Human Torch, Mr. Fantastic, Invisible Girl, and The Thing, and vow to spend their lives fighting all sorts of evil menaces which the normal forces of the world cannot cope with. And to keep it all from getting too goody-goody, there is always friction between Mr. Fantastic and The Thing, with Human Torch aiding with Mr. F. Also, the other three are
Mr. F.
Also, the other three are always afraid of The Thing getting out of their control someday and harming mankind with his amazing strength.
Right. And there's an element of that in the early days. Reed is always convinced that everyone he meets is going to turn on them someday.
I think the whole first year of the comic is just everyone they meet. That Spider-Man could probably destroy the world.
Yeah, Willy Lumpkin. I don't know.
He's very dangerous. He could generate some kind of ripple effect with his ear wiggling. Occasionally, also, you might have The Thing wanting to do something for personal profit and the other three try to stop him. In other words, The Thing doesn't have the ethics that the other three have, and consequently, he will probably be the most interesting one to the reader because he'll always be unpredictable.
Yeah. Again, this is the Hulk that he's talking about here. That's where all that stuff winds up going. And it turns out the Hulk was not that interesting to the reader. You know, I mean, not in the early days, like they figured that character out, but I understand where Stan's coming from. Like, in theory, like, yeah, it is kind of intriguing to have three heroes and a villain, like, having to work together,
right?
You know, but I think, in the episodic nature of comics and, you know, they're essentially like pretty basic morality plays. Like, mm-hmm. It doesn't really work, you know, especially where, if like, even in a comic, if you have the same villain show up issue after issue after issue, like, that just gets old.
Yeah. Somebody has to win.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Somebody has to lose.
Right.
But also, The Thing just isn't, he is a wild card. I mean, he has a temper.
Yeah.
He breaks things. He occasionally screws up a plan because he's his temper, or,
right,
you know, screws up a phase of a plan, but they still work it out.
Right.
But yeah, so there's the, you know, when you get to that sort of classic team scenario where you have the, you know, the, you have strength, you have the flyer, you have, you know, the sort of magic powers, the elemental powers, but you also have wild card,
yeah,
the crazy person,
yeah,
the,
yeah,
you know, whatever it is, there's the, that, there's that, and he's sort of that it because of his just his nature,
yeah,
his temper.
Mm-hmm.
So Stan wraps up this part of the script with, "So much for the introduction. The proceeding should have covered exactly 11 pages, consisting of two chapters. Chapter one, 6 pages. Chapter two, 5 pages. Pretty close.
It
right?
comes out to 13 pages. So, yeah, you know, that's not a terrible estimate for a guy who just could not draw his way out of a paper bag.
Right. And who uses a lot of pronouns when describing what happens. I love that Reed's arm stretches when he reaches for a thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah.
the next two chapters in which the Fantastic Four undertakes their first case will be 3 chapters for a total of 13 pages. He fixed both of these numbers, like, yep, scratched them out and wrote them. And then 3, 5, 5 is what he had written at the end.
That's about right. Yeah. I mean, it comes out to be, so the first issue of Fantastic Four is 25 pages long. So yeah, he was off by a couple pages, but on the whole, he did a pretty good job estimating, which tells me that Jack was involved with this and like figuring out, it's like, okay, how much story can we actually get into, you know, one book? And you definitely want to have a guy who knows how to break down a story into pages to be able to help you estimate that.
Yeah, obviously he knows more than just even visual pacing of the story. He,
yeah,
knows he's got some insights. What he chooses to put down, really, I think, what he draws, what he, yeah, chooses to draw from this, assuming again, there, I mean, in anything I can imagine with directing artists, there would be hours of conversation between this. And I know,
oh, yeah,
with the early Marvel bit, there probably was nothing. I mean, that's part of why there's like post-it note things like, "Jack, before you draw the sexy invisible lady, come talk to me." It's like, it's just,
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, as a whole, like, this is, you know, if this is the result of, you know, a conversation that Stan and Jack had about what the Fantastic Four was going to be, it's actually like amazingly on point. I'd say like 80% of this makes it into the first issue. And, you know, the other 20%, almost all of that winds up getting recycled into other things like the Hulk, you know, the Things character winds up becoming the Hulk.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing that really they wound up not doing at all is Sue having to get naked to be invisible.
Right.
But I mean, like, the you know, as far as the rival for the affections, like, that winds up being transferred to Namor. So yeah, I mean, it just goes to show, you know, when you've got two guys who are professionals and working in such an unforgiving pace as the comics publishing industry is, like, you don't throw anything away. If you can, if you can find a place to put it somewhere else, like, do that. But you just, like, no one has enough of creative flow to be able to, you know, afford to get rid of anything unless you've really done a really good job of trying to figure out where else you can stick it. So,
and also consider, this is another thing I read today from Stan, when between the time of 1939, when he started at Timely,
yeah,
and 1961, he didn't specify when he was paid this, but he said writers were paid 50 cents a page.
Wow.
So, and yeah, artists were paid a little bit more. He didn't specify how much more.
Right, right.
But so you get the idea that if you want to make a living wage, you've got to generate way more than one comic book. You've,
oh,
got to,
yeah,
generate tons.
Yeah, and you still do in, yeah, comics, honestly. Like, I mean, there's a few folks who've gotten very fortunate with their creator owned work where they, you know, they have 100% of the ownership and they can get the royalties on it and they can get the, you know, film and TV rights and things like that. But yeah, I mean, if you're trying to make a living in the world of comic books right now, like, if you're not writing 2 or 3 books a month, I don't know how you're paying your bills.
Yeah. And you're still living like a lowly musician at that point.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, great. I think that was fun. It's fascinating to see where this stuff comes from. This is also like, this is kind of an artifact that has been floating around for a long time. There's a lot of controversy around it, which, mm-hmm, I think makes it interesting. But also, like, regardless of, you know, ownership and you know, who created what, I think it's just fascinating to see a snapshot of, here's what we think this is going to be. And then seeing what comes of it.
Yeah. And it's again, we've said this before at the beginning of this series, we say it fairly often, but yeah. This is the genesis of the entire Marvel superhero universe.
Yeah, totally.
So although there were superheroes in Marvel before or in Timely, this is what we know of as the Marvel universe.
Yes.
So,
This is the Dead Sea Scrolls of the Marvel Universe.
This is where it all started. This is where all of the imperfections that may have been edited out or changed later.
Yep.
Just like the Dead Sea Scrolls and are put in here. So it is. And I've read a few other things in some of these, especially read this facsimile edition if you want to get some more background story, the behind the scenes. There's a few different writers and artists who have comments about, including Stan,
mm-hmm.
Who talk about what this means. Like, again, this is the start of an entire universe.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And then if I can recommend a couple books that are definitely worth checking out. So Marvel Comics, The Untold Story by Sean Howe. Is a really great read. It's out in paperback, so very affordable. It's a meaty book, but it reads real quickly, and just kind of a fascinating behind the scenes view. And then also mentioned earlier, Mark Evanier's Kirby King of Comics, as far as a biography of Jack Kirby goes, just top notch. And Evanier is a really good guy. He's got a, I think it's Notes from ME is his regular, it's basically a blog. He's kind of seen and done it all, in comics and animation. He knew Jack really well in the '70s when he was, just a kid and working as his assistant. So,
yeah. And, totally, I don't know if this is worth mentioning, but, one of the best books, and it's fiction or historical fiction, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
Yes, by Michael Chabon.
Yeah. So it's essentially, keep this in mind, when Stan started at Timely, the two people running it were Joe Simon and Jack Kirby.
Yep.
And this, the book, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, is about, you know, roughly about the story of these two creators, the creators of Superman.
Yeah.
Eventually. But it includes so many, classic New York things, office in the Empire State Building, and so much more about their Jewish heritage, about so many complicated things. And it's a beautiful, beautiful book. So if you, I'm just, you know, guessing some of you aren't going to read a book that is, or the books that we're talking about that are more bios. But if you want something that gives you a good swath of the early comics industry, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, by Michael Chabon.
Yep.
Is also a great book. So
yeah.
I think I've now read two of the three we've talked about, and I have not read Mark Evanier's book, weirdly, because I've read so much of his work.
Yeah. Yep.
And I've even been to see him talk at Comic Cons and never read this. So that's next on my list.
Yeah. Well, I'm forever in debt to Mark Evanier because he was the writer collaborator on Gru the Wanderer.
I read Gru,
and he did all the letter columns, and he published one of my letters when I was a boy.
So I think it's
the only letter I've ever had published in a comic book, but it was in a Gru the Wanderer comic. So
that's awesome.
Yep.
And I own that, and it's bagged and boxed
there
in
go.
My basement.
See. Cool. And also, you know, if you want to continue learning more about Marvel Comics history, we got a podcast for you. It's called Marvel by the Month. And usually we're pretty good about, you know, doing each week an episode about 1 month in the publishing history of Marvel Comics. So check it out sometime. And I think that's it.
Yeah.
So until next time, I'm going to be Brian Stratton.
And I probably will be Rob Milne.
And we will see you, I swear to God this time, next week for next month.